The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, and welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, November 16th, 2007. This is episode number 104. I am Bob Hayes, your host, here today to talk about MotoGP with you guys. So we got some stuff on tap for today. Fairly interesting show. A little bit shorter than they've been over the past few weeks, but I think that's kind of a good thing. Probably going to keep it under an hour or so today. We're going to start off with a couple of emails and a little announcement about a charity thing we got going on that I think is kind of interesting. Then we're going to talk to Kelly Welsh. She's the producer of The Kentucky Kid, the show that's going to be on MTV about Nicky Hayden and MotoGP. And if you haven't heard about that, it's on tonight. Hopefully you're listening to the show on Friday because it's Friday, November 16th. It's going to be on MTV in the United States at 10 o'clock. And that's Pacific time and Eastern time, 10 p.m. On MTV. So make sure you catch that. And it's going to be a good one. It looks really good. And Kelly telling us a few of the inside details about that and coming up in the show a little bit. Then we got a call with Jules and we did some talking about a variety of different things. Just the usual kind of thing where we sort of just chat about MotoGP and a variety of different subjects. Very interesting stuff. I think you're going to enjoy it. Before we get to all of that, let me start off with an email I received about last week's show, and this is from Kev Ryder, and he kind of took me to task here for some comments I made, and I probably deserve this. He says, just playing the latest podcast wherein your craps dealer buddy talks about the ignorance of the general public regarding MotoGP. There's a revelation, and a good point. He mentioned Barry Sanders and that he doesn't know his number, and he says, Kev Ryder says, you proudly added that you don't even know who he is, and I thought it ironic that race fans ridicule those who don't know the superstars of the grid. Barry Sanders was a Hall of Fame running back on a pathetic Detroit Lions team. Sanders never won a championship, unlike Rossi, but like Rossi of 2007, his efforts and talents were all for naught, as football is a team sport and his supporting cast was incapable of reaching that ultimate goal. Okay, you never played stick and ball sports and hence have no appreciation for them. I can respect that. Personally, I don't get golf, but I thought it ironic that you demonstrated the reason that motorcycle racing will always be small time in the U.S., meaning non-participation, hence lack of interest, while simultaneously denigrating those who know nothing of GP. And, okay, you're right, Kev. I probably deserved that. But I didn't really mean it to come across that, you know, that I was sort of proud of not knowing who Sanders was. I was basically saying to Lee that, well, you know, don't feel bad that you don't know his number because I don't even know who he is. But I have said things. I've made sort of snide remarks about golf and things like that. This is a show about MotoGP, and I know in my heart, in my head, what is the most exciting sport out there, and it's MotoGP. And I tend to like motorsport in general, meaning racing, a variety of different kinds, and I'm not a big fan of stick and ball. I've made no secret of that, and it's a fact that's well known. On the other hand, I shouldn't bag on people that do appreciate those sports, that do like that kind of stuff, because there's a variety of different reasons of why people like sports. One of my theories is, and this is not exactly a very original theory, but people tend to like the things that they do, which explains a lot of the popularity of golf. Because let's face facts, I'm not knocking golf when I say that golf is a pretty slow game to watch. I mean, it can have some exciting moments when the guy, you know, does a fantastic drive or, you know, makes a great putt or whatever, these kind of things going on. But by and large, I mean, that's a boring sport. But it's hugely popular on television, much more popular in the United States than any motorsport, and with huge amounts of money involved. So this is because people play golf and they like to see people playing the game that they play and they enjoy. And I've said this before, and it's a fact. And the thing is, with motorcycle racing, most motorcycle racing fans are also motorcycle riders. And what we need to do, besides, of course, getting more people to ride motorcycles, that would be a fantastic thing in America. But even if you can just get past that and say, you know, look at these guys, even if you don't ride a motorcycle, this is a fantastic sport. It's very, very interesting to watch. Say, for instance, bull riding. Bull riding is very popular. Vast majority of the United States have probably never ridden a bull. So, you know, it doesn't always have to be that way, where you have to participate in something that is sort of like that sport in order to appreciate that sport. And I think that that is true. And what we need to do is, you're right, Kev, rather than me knocking stick and ball sports, what I should do is to promote MotoGP as much as possible to my stick and ball sports loving friends. And I do. So, sorry about that. I didn't mean to come across that way. I don't ever want to mean to be overly snarky. I like a little bit of a smart-ass sort of an attitude and all of that. And I'll, like I said, make no secret of the fact that I don't really care for other certain sports. And even some motorsport series I will occasionally make fun of, because this is a show about MotoGP, but I'll try to keep it nice. All right, the next thing is on a much more positive note, and this is from Darren Carpenter, who's a kind of a big helper of MotoGPOD. He helped us out. He wrote that spreadsheet last week that we talked about that analyzed the Valencia numbers. He's done some stuff for track days. We've got some stuff kind of waiting in the wings that's from Darren that we're going to be using in some future shows. He's a good guy all around. He races up there in the OMRA series, Oregon Motorcycle Road Racing Association, up there in Portland. And what Darren sends us is an email. I am taking part in the Portland Mustaches for Kids to raise money for the Make-A-Wish Foundation of Oregon. All right, anybody who's not familiar with the Make-A-Wish Foundation, this is a great organization that gives money to little kids who are typically suffering from a variety of horrific diseases and things, and it grants them their wish of, you know, typically it's stuff like, you know, go to Disney World or space camp or whatever it is, things that they can't afford to do that they might not be able to do because of their condition, a variety of different reasons, and the Make-A-Wish Foundation makes that possible for them. It's a really good thing. It's nice, and it's good stuff. So Darren is doing this Portland Mustaches for Kids. What is Mustaches for Kids, you ask? Darren writes, Mustaches for Kids is a volunteer-run organization that does good and has fun by growing mustaches for children's charities. Really. Since its humble beginnings, that was Darren's really, not my really, so don't accuse me of being a smartass, anybody. Since its humble beginnings, Mustaches for Kids satellite chapters all across the continent have raised over $150,000 for charity. And here's how it works. From mid-November to mid-December, the Mustaches for Kids Portland growers will cultivate sweet mustaches and solicit pledges from friends, family, co-workers, and community members, kind of like getting pledges to run a marathon, except they're just growing a mustache. The growing season will culminate with a stash bash, a cross between a beauty pageant, dog show, and police lineup. During the competition, the growers, often in mustache-enhancing costumes, will be put through a test of mind, body, and mustache before a panel of judges declares one mustache as Portland's sweetest. So please help Darren raise money by pledging to sponsor his stash, which would also be a nice Christmas and or birthday present. For all my sponsors, I will email you a photo weekly showing you how my stash is progressing, as well as a final photo from the stash bash. That alone right there is going to be worth the cost of the pledge, folks. If you want to make a contribution, and you don't have to make a contribution to Darren, you can make your contribution to a variety of different people in the Mustaches for Kids, or you can just make it direct to Make-A-Wish Foundation. But in any event, if you'd like to sponsor Darren, I'll put you in contact with him. How about that? You can either email him directly at m4kpdx@gmail.com and say that it's for Darren. That's M and then the numeral 4kpdx@gmail.com, which sounds extremely confusing until you sort of analyze it. That's Mustaches for Kids, and then PDX is Portland's airport code. So m4kpdx@gmail.com. Mention that it's going for Darren Carpenter's fantastic mustache. Or if you send me an email at bob@motogpod.com and saying, you know, you're interested in all that, I'll put you in contact with Darren one way or the other. He does have membership levels here. I thought this was kind of fun. Sponsorship levels, $1 to $15, Ned Flanders. $16 to $30, Sonny Bono. $31 to $50, Cary Grant. $51 to $100 Groucho Marx, and $100 plus is Magnum PI. So Magnum PI gets the big mustache. One thing I did point out to Darren is I don't remember ever seeing a picture of Cary Grant with a mustache. I think somebody's confused there, and they're maybe thinking Clark Gable or I don't know, Errol Flynn or David Niven or one of these other mustached guys, but not Cary Grant. But no matter who it is, or maybe it is Cary Grant, and it's just a slam on it's not enough money because it doesn't have a mustache. So whatever. It's kind of a cool thing. I thought it was good fun. I sent Stashmaster D a check, and I hope that you will consider doing so as well. Now, let's see. That's quite a bit of non-MotoGP-ish stuff that we just talked about there, but I think it was still interesting and somewhat relevant. And why don't we now get on with some MotoGP-type stuff and launch into that interview with Kelly Welch. All right, we got Kelly Welch on the phone today. Kelly is a producer for working with MTV. She's doing The Kentucky Kid, the reality series about Nikki Hayden that's going to be coming up here on MTV in the United States starting tonight, the day of this very show. So, hi, Kelly. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks. This is kind of somewhat eagerly awaited for MotoGP fans, at least MotoGP OD fans, because we've heard about this since, well, at least February. I remember hearing about it. And it's sort of a long-awaited thing, so we're kind of looking forward to it. How did this kind of come about? How did you sort of get involved with this?
Let me just correct you. It's actually not a series. It's a two-hour documentary film. So it's premiering tomorrow night, Friday night, November 16th at 10 o'clock on MTV in the U.S. We're hoping at some point that MTV Europe and some of the other sister channels are going to pick it up, but that's not confirmed as of yet. So for right now, it's just in the States. But I initially got involved with it back in February. MTV had done a pilot with Nikki in 2006, the last two races in Portugal and Valencia. She won the championship, and then after that, they greenlit it and had us really follow Nikki from the start of the 2000 season up until Portugal we were with him.
Okay, interesting. So, wow. Now, was this initially supposed to be a series? Because I'm sure I remember reading things about 8-part series.
Yes, initially when it was first picked up, it was going to be a series, but they actually started this new, I guess you call it a genre on the channel, where they're doing kind of, they're like made for television films, and they decided that with this particular project that they wanted to, it's the first of its kind on the channel, and it's actually preceding Madonna, who is going to have the second kind of made for television movie for MTV, so it's in very good company. But yeah, initially it was a series, but they decided that they wanted to make it into a doc film, which we actually were really excited about. It gave us a little bit of a chance to kind of play around with the format. It's not a reality show. It is a documentary. I think obviously there is a very distinct difference there. So I'm really proud. I'm really proud of the format and the way that the film came out. And I think it was a good decision. I think it was a good move to go with the film as opposed to, a reality series.
Great. Now, that actually takes so much of the wind out of my sails as far as the questions I was going to ask you.
Okay.
We had, like I said, in reading the early press releases and articles and mentions about this, it was billed as a reality show. And I know that some of your credits include things like The Osbournes and stuff. And not that those are bad shows. It's just MotoGP is MotoGP, and we don't want it being put into, Earl Hayden's version of My Three Sons or something.
Exactly. So. And, I understand that, reality now kind of, can come with some negative connotations. I'm happy to be, it's definitely distinctive from the reality shows that you see on MTV. There's nothing in the show that was staged or, manipulated. We didn't throw Nikki in crazy, contrived situations. It really is a documentary. We followed him, what he did, what he didn't do. So you can assure your viewers that it's definitely not your standard MTV fair, I guess you could say. Although, like you said, I did work on The Osbournes, and I'm really proud of that show as well. That was a series that, came kind of in the beginning when this genre took off. And again, that was really kind of doc-style too. So,
right. And I didn't mean to necessarily knock The Osbournes. I mean, that kind of show has its place. And actually, I kind of liked The Osbournes.
Right.
I thought that one was funny. But
a lot of people did.
It wouldn't be suitable for Nikki Hayden. I mean, I suppose you could make a show like that. But, it's not something. Yeah. So
totally. No, I get it. I understand that people are a little nervous, I know there's a lot of diehards, a lot of hardcore fans of the sport, and I really did want to make sure that the film had integrity and it treated the sport with respect and Nikki with respect, because he absolutely deserves it. And I think that we did that. I think when people see it, you know, I think that's what they're going to come away with. That's right. I hope they come away with that. We treated the sport right, and we did respect it, and that there's, you know, substance to the project.
Good deal. That's going to be super great. So now, were you a MotoGP fan before this project, and are you now a MotoGP fan?
I will admit that when I first started, I knew nothing about the sport. You know, the first race that I went to was the opening race of 2007 in Qatar, and I can tell you that by the end of that race weekend, I did become a fan. I'm a huge fan now. You know, even at the races that we weren't at, you know, I was on MotoGP.com watching the practices and the qualifying, you know, and the race, of course. And I'm a huge fan. And I, you know, I can say that for all the people that worked with me. You know, I had a really great, amazing crew. And we all fell in love with the sport. So, Good. Yes, absolutely.
That's excellent. How did you shoot the movie? Or what was it? Were you using film? Were you using HD? What was the format that you shot in?
We actually shot, we had two cameras. We had a GVX100, and then we had a GVC Pro. We shot in 30p. It's not HD. You know, we would have liked to, but as you can imagine, there was, you know, a ton of travel on the show. And, you know, we kind of had to streamline it. You know, we obviously also didn't want to be a distraction to Nikki. You know, we were in the garage with Nikki at every race, you know, for all his practices, for qualifying, for warm-up. So we kept it really small. I had a group of, like, 2 to 3 guys. Cameron Glendening was my director, my DP, and Jason LaCorey was my tech soup and my assistant camera, and I had Byron Miller as my audio soup. So it was literally just the four of us for most of the season. We kept it really small. You know, to keep that distraction minimal. You know, we wanted to be there, obviously, for everything, but, you know, didn't want to take away, you know, from anything that Nikki was doing, so kept it small.
That makes a lot of sense. Did you go to every round or most of them? Or?
We did, actually. We didn't go to every round, but we went to a lot. We went to Qatar. We went to Jerez. We went to Istanbul. We went to Le Mans, Donington, Assen, Laguna Seca. And then we actually went to Portugal. So I think at the end we ended up going to, I think, 11 out of the 18 rounds. So we went to quite a bit. Yeah, and then I actually just got back. I went to Valencia myself, but not to shoot, just to support. So I actually ended up going to one more.
Oh, wow. That's cool. As a fan, even. So great. You must have got a considerable amount of footage. How difficult of a job was that to edit that down to 2 hours?
We did have a lot of footage, but we, you know, we had a great post team that was back in Santa Monica, California. You know, we were sending back footage, you know, pretty much after every race we would come back with all of the tape. You know, and that all got logged by our loggers and then looked at by our assistant story editors and then made its way up to, obviously, you know, our executive producers and myself included. Me being on the road, you know, I was really familiar with all of the footage, so I was able to give them, you know, a really good head start on, you know, what was important and what was going on with Nikki.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, because that does sound like quite a job. I know how difficult
it was. It was a lot of footage to cut down to, you know, essentially what became a 2-hour film.
Sure. Any possibilities that this project is going to turn up on DVD, perhaps with some of the extra uncut or cut out footage and that sort of thing?
You know, we're actually talking to Nikki's camp and to Dorna, and we're hoping that we actually can release this on DVD sometime in the future. You know, it's not confirmed now, but it's something that you know, that we're definitely talking about.
Okay. Cool. And now, are there any projects that you're aware of to maybe possibly continue on in this vein? I mean, it's sort of somewhat endless, the things that you could do in MotoGP, or even when she started talking about superbikes. Is there anything that you're thinking about?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I would love, like I said, I really, really fell in love with sport. I'm a huge fan now. You know, working with Nikki was a pleasure. He's an absolute, he's a doll, you know, he's a professional. I could not respect him more, and I would love to continue on, but we'll have to see how the show does tomorrow night. Hopefully it'll do well, and then who knows? You never know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sounds good. Now, is tomorrow night the only night it's scheduled for on MTV, or are they going to be rerunning it?
Well, right now it's scheduled for 10 o'clock, and then there's a second airing at 2 a.m., and right now those are the only two dates that we have, but, you know, MTV, it's known for repeating things quite a bit. So we're hoping that after the weekend, when we get the ratings and we see, you know, how it does, we're hoping that the network will want to show it more.
Okay. Well, hopefully we get enough listeners on board that have heard this show today, Friday, for the listeners when the show goes up, mm-hmm. That they can watch the show in time and get out there 7 o'clock or 10 o'clock at specific times those are. So basically 10 o'clock Eastern or Pacific, and you'll be good to go to watch show, right?
Yes, yes. Please, please watch. Please support. Please support Nikki. You know, obviously MotoGP is a sport. The more people, you know, especially in the United States that get to watch it, you know, better for the sport. I know that they would really like to break into this market, and I think it's absolutely deserving of that. So, you know, our hope is that a lot of people get to see it, and, you know, it really helps to build interest in the sport here in the States.
Great. And like I said earlier when we're talking, a lot of the MotoGPOD listener base is international, and you mentioned that it's being possibly considered for international. If a listener in the UK or something, if they want to contact somebody, who would be the best person to send an email to or write a letter or whatever to say, look, I'd like to see this?
They should definitely go on the web. You can go to MTV Europe, you know, depending where you are. And you should definitely contact your local MTV station and tell them that you want to see the Kentucky Kid.
All right, we'll put that out there, and we'll include a couple of links on the MotoGPOD website to try to get people to do that, and we'll see what we can do to support the show. Great. All right, well, thank you very much for being on the show here, Kelly, and taking the call. Appreciate the time.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to spread the word about the show.
No problem. We'll get you as many viewers as we can. Bye-bye.
Okay, great. Thanks, Bob.
So, we got Jules on the phone today. Good morning, Jules. How are you doing today?
Good morning, Bob.
Good deal. And we're going to talk a little bit about MotoGP, which is kind of a strange thing because that's what this show's about. So, got a few emails you and I did, Jules, and some interesting stuff to talk about. Plus, there's testing. There's still stuff going on. People are concerned. You know, it's the off-season. You know, what's going to happen? And it's like, you know, there's still a wealth of interesting stuff to talk about. And you do have the December sort of test ban and all of that. But even then, I'm sure that there will be things to talk about because it seems like MotoGP is starting to develop a bit like Formula One and NASCAR and those kind of sports where half the time some of the interesting stories that you're reading in the news don't even involve anything on the track. So we will bring you our opinion of those stories as well. But in any case, let's talk about what's some of the stuff that's been lately in the news and on the emails. What do you want to start with, Jules?
Let's talk about some of the emails we got from the last show.
Okay, I think that's a great idea. One that we got from Alan in San Francisco, Alan Clarkson Dodds, says, thanks for the show. And he says, something that wasn't mentioned during last week's Valencia wrap-up was the outstanding job that Pedrosa did. He had that Honda so out of shape so often that it was hard to believe it was the same Robot Lions guy that we've been watching come up through the ranks. He's been showing signs of an ability to push it beyond the limit more than a few times this year. There was a couple of times on the first corner at Valencia that he had it in full Freddy mode, sliding the front and back with the thing bucking away like a 500. It was great to watch. He's clearly stepped up to another level from being lapped at a wet Phillip Island a couple of years ago. He is now a front runner in the rain as well. I'm actually starting to enjoying watching him. And basically then it's kind of, you know, what did you think? And do you think it's because the Honda is so bad that he's had to ride it at 110%? Or is he showing an ability that most of us sort of doubted that he had or what? And I thought that was kind of an interesting question. We didn't give him enough cred. We kind of glossed right over his performance there at Valencia, and that wasn't real fair of us. But I thought you had some pretty good points on that.
I think that the reason why Pedrosa isn't getting the kind of street cred that he should be getting is because we had really high expectations of him this season, that he would be the title contender the entire season. And that didn't happen. So we already know that he's really good. He blew us away last year with this incredible, really one of the most amazing rookie years. And we kind of got accepted that he's a front runner, and that it was more of a surprise when he didn't do well this year. than it was when he did. But we got to remember that actually the second half of the season, he's been doing amazingly well. He won a race at Sachsenring, and then after that, he had good results pretty much all the way through. And those four poles at the end, and you know, fighting for podiums, and most importantly, he achieved what we all just assumed was impossible to the point where nobody even was talking about it, which was to take second place away from Valentino Rossi. There was only one way he could do it, which was one that Rossi would have some kind of a problem, which Rossi did, and then that he won the race, which he did. That Pedrosa would win the race, and he did.
Right, that was a long shot, and I wish I'd been paying attention to like the odds makers, betting sites, and all of that sort of a thing to see what the odds were on that. I'm sure there somebody somewhere had established odds, because that would have been kind of an interesting tidbit of knowledge. But unfortunately, you know, I didn't do that. So, one thing though is that the fact that we somewhat discounted him, that we expected him to do so well, and then when he just sort of did moderately well at the beginning of the season, do you think that points to that the Honda was just the factory was so caught out, and the bike was just that bad, even though this is a bike that was specifically made for Pedrosa, almost with to all intents and purposes, you know, with Hayden saying that, you know, that the factory told him that, you know, hey, we really designed this bike for Pedrosa, and it was too small for all the other riders.
It's pretty obvious that the bike got better throughout the season because everybody on Honda started doing better. Marco Melandri, the only rider that was doing well in the Honda in the early part of the season was Tony Elias.
Right.
And, you know, but during the second half of the season, we saw like this resurgence in Hayden. We saw a resurgence in Marco Melandri, and even Carlos Checa started getting some decent results. So, definitely the bike got better. And like you said, it was a bike that was especially suited for Pedrosa, so he took the most advantage out of it. I think all the whole field really like kind of caught up to took the entire season really to catch up to the Ducati Bridgestone phenomenon, but you know, except for Yamaha.
yeah, and that's true. And actually, Michael Scott wrote about that in Cycle News this week, talking about the when we have a change, a big change in the rules, or just whatever. When we have a change in MotoGP, that typically the manufacturers will try different approaches, and then you'll find the one that works. And eventually, all the manufacturers will just gravitate towards that approach anyway. And whether that's just a fact of engineers copying one another, because, you know, what is it? Good artists copy bad artists steal, good artists copy, or vice versa, or whatever it is that Picasso said. And it works for engineering as well. Or it's just that simply that it is a combination of not so much just copying, but just, hey, this is what works. And Michael Scott's point was that, yeah, that specifically with the reduction in fuel cell size from 22 down to 21 liters, all the other factories were, besides Ducati, were intentionally somewhat, they were worried about running out of fuel, so they kind of kept the power down to save fuel, whereas Ducati relied on engine management and trickery, basically, within the electronics to allow them to have full power, but saving fuel at certain times and this and that, which is a very much of an oversimplification, but I think it kind of states the point, and that was one thing. And then also the V4 engine configuration. Scott was saying, how long is it going to be until Kawasaki and Yamaha go to a V4 as opposed to an inline 4, simply because it might be the way to go, which that one I'm not too sure about, but we might see. You never know.
Yeah, I think the big advantage there is the same. It's, you know, you got the small motor you're going to pneumatic valves and stuff like that, and you want basically more room. And in a V configuration, you have more room around the cylinder heads.
And, right. You also have a narrower side to side, so you can tend to do quicker direction changes because your crank is shorter.
Yep.
But you do have a longer front to back configuration.
Right, so the wheelbase is longer, possibly. I think a bigger problem is the fact that even though these engines are obviously liquid-cooled, the rear cylinders of a V always tend to overheat as opposed to the front cylinder, so you have to account for that.
Exactly.
Especially the speeds these guys are running.
Yeah, and we might see Kawasaki and Yamaha move to that, but it doesn't look like it's going to happen next year, that's for sure. No. Although we did, we got the pneumatically valved Honda. I checked on that fact after our last call. Just to double check that we didn't have a Desmo, because there were rumors that Honda's researching Desmo, and that would have been kind of an interesting one. But
Hayden confirmed that he did that there was a Desmo motor, and I guess they were testing that with a test rider out in Japan. But the motor that they brought to Valencia for the first postseason test was a pneumatic motor, and it was, it did well in the testing. Right. So.
Yeah, and I kind of think that's more of a natural thing for Honda, to be honest with you. And had they gone with a Desmo, I'm not sure of what their decisions were of Desmo versus pneumatic. They probably, hopefully it boiled down to a performance decision, but it might have boiled down somewhat to a, this looks like we're copying Ducati decision, and that they weren't prepared quite so much to look like, oh, wow, Ducati got it right and Honda did not.
I think that goes a long way. That argument goes a long way because there's a certain kind of pride that Honda has.
Oh, yeah.
And the Ducati really, the factory has always stuck to their trellis frame and the Desmodronic valves. I think we talked about this before, so we're not going to get too much into it, but those are signature marks of the Ducati.
Exactly, and that's true, and they want to, they actually wanted to run a V-twin in MotoGP, and they just couldn't, they realized that, no, it's not going to be competitive.
Yep.
So they sort of made a V4 that's a lot like a V-twin. This is true. You want your brand. You have to have, your brand of what you do, but Honda does a little of everything on their street bikes. So, they could kind of get away with these sort of decisions, I think. But yeah, it would still look a bit like they were copying Honda or copying Ducati. One thing, talking about Honda, I just noticed a commercial, and I don't watch a lot of commercials because I have the DVR, and I do the skipping thing.
Yep.
But this one happened to catch my eye because it had a Who song behind it. And it was interesting looking, and they're showing all kinds of cool Honda things. It started off with like an airplane, and then there was that solar powered car, and then Indy car and race cars, and this and that, and crashing cars into barriers and airbags exploding and engineers and all this good stuff. Good commercial. Not one single motorcycle in the whole thing, and it was a little bit like you guys are showing off your engineering talent and how great your cars are because the factory is just this live our dream or whatever the slogan was, and you don't have a motorcycle, which is what Honda's true roots are. And I was a little perturbed, to say the least, that they didn't even give one nod to motorcycles.
That is interesting, and I think that the motorcycle and auto arms of Honda are not really that far apart in terms of political structure over there. So that's really odd. Well, it's also for the American market, which is still kind of, 99.9% auto and 0.1% motorcycle.
Exactly. Yeah. Did you see the latest round of AMA type things about, that there's another attempt to ban or severely regulate sport bikes? And basically they're saying that sport bikes are responsible for X percent of motorcycle crashes, while completely ignoring the fact that younger riders tend to be these guys that are crashing. So maybe it's not the motorcycle, but the age of the rider and experience of the rider. But
yeah, the studies are just bull.
Oh, they're crap. Until they do another hurt report, there's really nothing that they have. They don't have any good data, and they just they pull stuff out of their ass, frankly. But the thing is that they convince lawmakers to look at this, and the lawmakers, oh yeah, you're right. Look at that. Oh, let's ban those nasty sport bikes. They're a bunch of punks anyway. And next thing you got problems. So another call to action from the AMA. And if you're in most American in the AMA and all that, go check out their website and figure out what to do. Okay. Now let's talk about the next email. One of the other ones we want to talk about, get back on track here a little bit. This one came from Terry James, longtime listener, and he was talking about where we, in our last call, had mentioned the poll that was on the MotoGP.com website of which rider are we going to see doing the most improvement. And both you and I said Hopkins, although the poll results were Lorenzo, right?
Kind of unfair to, because we were talking about who made the best switch.
Exactly. So we, in our internal debate, we just kicked out Lorenzo out of our calculations because, yeah, I didn't. It's a little bit like the rule change. It's too much, too big of a switch, and you don't have, you know, one thing to compare him to. So I thought that was silly to even include him in the first place. But Terry James says, Colin Edwards has my vote. He'll surprise everyone by doing better on a satellite team than he did on his factory ride. Most likely it's his last year, so he's got nothing left to lose. And I'd sure like to see him ride for the win rather than always being a stooge for Rossi. Yeah, wow. What do you think of that one?
Well, I think that, in a way, Colin's last year could have been this year, so I don't see why he wouldn't have been riding it all out this year. Granted, he was on Rossi's team, and the moment that the factory team starts to fall behind, I'm sure that all resources go to Rossi and Colin suffers. But at the same point, you could say, well, I'm sure that trickles down to the Tech 3 team as well, they suffer because the factory team is suffering.
Probably even more so.
So he's going to be on this satellite team. I think that all this Rossi talk about moving to Bridgestone and then moving to, you know, even threatening to leave Yamaha is going to... No, motivate is an interesting word to use here because it's a threat. It's more like extortion, but I think basically that he's not going to have great support from the factory. We can't expect him to have better support than he did have this year. He's going to have pretty much the same equipment that he had this year, like in the pecking order sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think he was already, a lot of people already thought this was his last year. His contract was up. So I don't think the situation has changed. So unless he actually has some real reason to try harder, or he was really suffering from some problems this year that are going to get corrected next year, I just don't see him doing that much better.
I tend to agree. Basically, and I would say it boils down to probably tires as much as anything. Colin was doing, he could qualify. He just couldn't make the race tires last. Michelin get it wrong enough.
It was just a lasting issue. He couldn't make good starts. He was in the middle of the pack by the end of the first lap, pretty much every race.
Right.
He just had a mediocre year. And he had such high hopes for this year. When we talked to him over the winter, and he was just saying, man, Michelin's got this tire. I just can't wait to ride it. And it's going to be an amazing year for us. And, you know, it's just materialized. So, I don't know. I mean, Michelin may pull. I really do think that Michelin will. They're not going to leapfrog Bridgestone. I think we talked about this last time. It's like... I think that Bridgestone basically caught up to Michelin in terms of the fact that they are now good at every track, and you're not going to have this same kind of leapfrog effect with Michelin passing Bridgestone again, unless every track out there gets repaved or redone. You know, so I think that we're going to see a very good tire war next year between Michelin and Bridgestone, and I think that... there's not going to be this big difference between the tires anymore.
Right. I agree.
So that will help Colin. But, you know, I just don't see him getting extra motivated. I don't think there was a lack of motivation this year. I think he's just not up to par the racing. This is probably a little too much, saying too much. Like, I don't think he's not up to par with these guys, but... he may be done.
Right, exactly. You know? I mean, and it's not saying in a bad way. You know, people age, and the younger guys come up, and whatever it is, the reaction time, the no distractions of having kids or whatever it is, the younger guys win. Yeah. You know, and there's always the sayings of, you know, old age and treachery and all of that, but
it only goes so far.
Exactly. It only goes so far. So that might be something. I think it's going to be interesting to see how well he does with James Toseland as a teammate, because we've seen both of them are two-time champions, world champions in World Superbike. They were they raced against one another in World Superbike. And so, you know, they've worked together, you know, to a limited extent before. And so that'll be kind of interesting. But more of the interesting part is going to be, is Toseland going to be consistently beating Edwards, or is Edwards going to consistently beat Toseland, or is it going to be a mixed bag, or what? You know, and so I'm kind of curious about seeing that one. And of course, the whole Lorenzo versus Rossi thing is just going to be amazing. So I think Yamaha has this fairly exciting rider lineup going on with these four guys. I think that's going to be two teams to watch right there.
Definitely, definitely. I think they're putting their future hopes in Lorenzo.
Yes.
And as far as the Tech 3, I mean, you know, Toseland is not exactly a young guy. I mean, so he's not like the difference between a 20-year-old and a 25-year-old is actually pretty big in MotoGP.
Sure.
because guys who are 25 years old in MotoGP usually have like 3 or 4 years under their belt already in MotoGP in that class. So,
sure.
You know, Toseland's kind of like a He's coming a little bit late. I think that's why he did jump into MotoGP this year, even though he, you know, the people are saying he's crazy to go on a satellite team and whatever. I think that's one of the reasons he needs to get there so he can have a year or two to get used to it and still have the energy and motivation to do some magic, because I think he's a very talented rider. He's a little dry, but he's a very talented rider.
Yes, I agree. And he doesn't have the background that Lorenzo's going to have of coming up through the GP ranks with the 125 and the 250s. He's coming over from World Superbike, somewhat different riding style, different circuits, a totally different air to the whole paddock thing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it is going to be sort of a learning year for him. And you're right, 25 is a little late to start, but it will still be interesting. And whether or not he's going to, you know, continue on and sort of turn into a bigger star or perhaps world champion, you know, who knows. But I agree that Yamaha is definitely banking on Lorenzo being the Pedrosa beater. You know,
right.
We've got the new generation of young guys coming up, kind of a thing, and all the factories are juggling around of who they're going to have, and it should be interesting stuff. And of course, everybody's still hoping for a return of Rossi, if you want to call it that, or whatever, because you know he is the greatest of all time and all of that, and
it's damn fun to watch.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And so, you know, I think Rossi would like to finish on a high note. I don't think he wants to have, you know, 3 years without a championship and just call it quits next year or something like that. So
there's no doubt he wants to leave on a high note. And this is not a high note.
No. Well, so we know he's coming back next year. He's coming back on the Bridgestones, which, did you see there's the Sprocket cartoons, the sarcastic little cartoons that you see on MotoGPnews.com and various websites and things, where there's the one where Rossi is telling Carmela Espolita, he says, "Give me Bridgestones or all. And then the next frame he says, "I'll never be world champion again."
I missed that one. That's great.
Yeah.
That's kind of funny. I think Lorenzo's has been amazing right from the first moment he got on the Yamaha. Like you look at Melandri, for example, getting used to Ducati. You know, he's saying, "Oh, I think I'm figuring it out. I think I'm figuring out the bike." Here's Lorenzo, who's never been on a 800cc MotoGP bike. He had some really good times that first time out in Valencia. He was in the top 10?
You're asking me these hard questions, Jules.
I think he was in
the top 10. I'll have to look at my results here real quick.
No, he wasn't. Sorry, he was not in the top 10. He was 11th.
Right, but still, just outside the top 10. And he did break into the top 10 at Sepang. We've got the times from the first day of testing at Sepang, which was wet, but he was 9th there.
Of course, I only see 10 riders.
Right, same here. So, notably in this, let's see, where did Rossi finish off?
Rossi hasn't been tested because
didn't test. What's that?
He is actually, I think, in a Michelin imposed test ban.
Yes, I'd forgotten about that because officially he's still at home recuperating from a broken hand. But you're right. The reason that he's not testing is more to do with the fact that Michelin won't let him.
Yep. So he has to finish the year, the contract. Overlooked
that.
Mm-hmm. So basically, he won't get to ride until after the winter break. Well, I mean, so it's a disadvantage. But then again, he is healing from that injury. I don't think he'd be getting that much data riding with injured because I think he'd be in pain still.
Yeah,
so.
I agree. So yeah, I was kind of gonna say, you know, is this gonna be a disadvantage for him? But you're right. It's sort of a double-edged sword, if you want to call it that. So it might be all for the best. And we've seen him do some amazing stuff, and I think we'll see it again. So,
definitely. One thing I wanted to mention about this Rossi Bridgestone switch is I had a conversation with a friend of mine who is Italian, and he reads a lot of the Rossi news in Italian, and he says that. There may have been some misquoting going on in terms of when Rossi was talking about that he's lost faith in Michelin's and that in reality what Rossi is saying is not that he's lost faith in Michelin as the company, but he's lost confidence in Michelin as the tire. And that's an interesting point of view because what Rossi is saying in that case is that the most important thing that a rider has going for him is confidence on the track, right?
Right.
We've talked to about this before. Liam brought it up a long time ago, saying, you know, this is really why certain riders are really good at certain tracks. Just feel extremely comfortable at a particular track, riding at particular lean angles and whatever. And Rossi's what in 2005. For example, even a little bit in 2006, he had tires that let him run all the way to the end of the race and set fastest laps at the end of the race, kind of the way Stoner's been doing on the Bridgestones. Whereas this year, it seems like the tire would go off and he just, you know, he was nursing the bike around all the time. So, you know, it's anything that's confidence eroding is going to be really significant. And I think a part of it, and this is, I think, what Rossi may be saying. This is what my friend says, maybe getting lost in the translation, including what Rossi says, because he himself is not a native English speaker. And he's very often like turning to somebody off camera and saying, you know, how do you say this word? You know,
right.
So, you know, I think that's an interesting twist on that, on the Rossi Michelin Bridgestone thing. I think he wants to be on a tire that he doesn't really have to think and worry about, that he can just ride, and that seems to be what Bridgestone has achieved.
Yeah. Now, will Rossi find a difference between the Yamahas and the Bridgestones? Randy DePunier was saying that he did not feel much of a difference going from Bridgestone to Michelin.
He's the first guy who said that, though.
Yeah. And it might say more for Randy DePunier's writing style and all of that than any or PR style than anything else. So that one is, you know, that's kind of a bit of a null data there. So it's kind of it'll be interesting to hear what Rossi has to say once he rides on those Bridgestones and gets out there, especially, you know, with this, he'll have the same bike. And that is also going to, the way that's going to play out with the whole Yamaha garage being split, I can't wait. It's going to be good stuff. It really is.
Definitely. I just wanted to mention that Nakano is extremely happy to be back on Bridgestones.
I think, yeah, he made a big mistake there. But when he went over to the
Calico team?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, just because of the Michelins and all of that. I'm not sure why did he leave Kawasaki?
Who knows? It's really hard to tell at this point.
I was out of the news at that point and everything. And I don't know if he was basically let go or if it was his decision or what. I just can't remember. You know, he's unfortunately, sorry, Nakano, but he somewhat falls below my radar and particularly last year.
He had a fantastic season last year in the Kawasaki. He had a couple podiums and,
in 2006, right?
Yeah. He led a race. If it wasn't for strategy due to the rain rules that I love so much, he may have had his first win. I think that he's happy to be back on Bridgestones. Meanwhile, that team, now in the guise of the Viziosos team, the Scott team, Viziosos is doing some really good stuff on this bike.
Yes, he is. He's getting up there in good times. Maybe it's a more of a team shakeup thing, or it could be. I mean, that's hard to say. There's, again, you've got enough changes going on that it's hard to pinpoint that there's this one thing. You can't just say, "Well, Dovizioso is a better rider than Nakano." It's not. You know, it's nothing like that, black and white. No. Yeah, he is. Again, I'm still looking at these Sepang lap times from which are in the wet, and Dovizioso was fourth.
Yep.
That's kind of interesting stuff. So another thing that's popped up in the news is the Qatar night races. We're going to have a night race next year at Qatar. They've got the lights going on. What's going on with that, Jules?
Well, they've got about a quarter of the track lit by a American lighting company called Musco, and the test went very favorably. The riders were kind of blown away by the effect that the lighting had. The biggest worry was the shadows. And because of the way the lights are set up, there's almost no shadow on the track. So it's a go. It's definitely going to happen. The track is still being completed. The lighting is being completed because it's only like a part of it that's been actually lit with the new lighting. The rest of it is using the old lighting that they tested back in 2005. Every manufacturer had a rider that tested, and they all gave a thumbs up, so it's a go. And I think it's going to be an extremely interesting thing to see, and it's going to change the way Qatar is raced, because Qatar is usually a big worry about, you know, the temperature of the tarmac and air temperature and dust drifting around. I guess the evenings are less windy, and so it's going to be just good all around.
Yeah, it's going to be neat all around. Very interesting to see. I somewhat mixed opinions on the whole thing. My first opinion is get rid of Qatar altogether. I think it's a stupid place to have a racetrack. But since that's not going to happen, and go back to Turkey. But since that's not going to happen, the night racing is probably a good idea. One thing that I'm a little skeptical or a little curious of how it's going to work out, or maybe it's just that I don't know the daily schedule well enough yet, is that these races are going to be happening somewhere around 10 o'clock at night, I think is the time that they're talking. Mm-hmm. And if they stick to that sort of schedule through the 3 days of the race weekend, the morning practice sessions are going to be in the daytime. And so what kind of data are you going to get, and what kind of issues are you going to run into with having the guys go out there in the late afternoon when it's, you know, hotter and blazes, and you've got low sun and things like this,
and then you know, then and then have to go to a nighttime where, you know, they are they're working on the shadows and all of this, but artificial light is never like the, you know, the big yellow ball. And I don't know about you, but writing at night for me is so completely different.
It's, you know,
and I mean, it, even with the brightly lit track and stuff, I think that it's going to be very, very different for these guys. And I'm also still wondering, lighting up a road course compared to, you know, lighting up an oval. NASCAR's been doing night races for a long time, but that's one thing that people have always liked about ovals is, you know, you can see the whole track and it's more like a stadium, sort of a situation. And so the lights at one end are basically helping to light up the other end and this and that. And even then, I'll bet, you know, I'm not a NASCAR fan at all, but I'm not familiar with enough with NASCAR to know what they say about, you know, the night races versus the day races. So, you know, I don't know. I'm a little skeptical and it'll be interesting to see how it pans out and if it does work. But are we going to see some sort of a trend? And this was actually mentioned in an email. I don't want to just steal this idea, but this one was from Emery James Baker. And he says, you know, night racing is going to be fun to see. And he says, let's face it, TV loves night events due to the visual impact. Do you think that, like many other sports, that we will see a mad rush to install lighting systems at tracks all over the world? And basically, my point is, on road courses, probably not. Unless the Qatar thing just turns out spectacularly well.
Well, I could totally think of another track that would work very well, which is Valencia.
Yes,
Valencia could totally have a lighting system put in. But I think that, you know, I mean, it would be just for spectacle only, because they really don't need it, because they're so late in the year that by this time the temperatures are pretty reasonable in Spain. So.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, yeah, even in the hottest part of the year, it gets hot, but it's not Qatar hot.
Right.
And, also with Valencia, I mean, gosh, think of how the increased security you'd have to keep everybody off the track at night.
Because
every time you have a GP in Spain, it's pandemonium. So I can only imagine what it would be like to actually have the race at night and people shooting fireworks across the track or something.
But. Anyway, I think it's going to be a really neat treat for us to see. And I, it's still not clear to me whether the bikes themselves will have any sort of lighting on them. I believe they won't, because that would be very distracting to the riders. In the photos that they have shown, the bikes do have lights, because they didn't actually use MotoGP bikes during this test.
Right, they also don't have the whole track. The track is not completely lit correctly, right? So, I mean, so
they were using, testing. Yeah, they were using bikes that actually had lights on them.
Yeah, right. But, yeah, so I think, though...
I'm pretty sure that they're not going to have lights on the bikes. That would be pretty distracting, I think.
Yeah, but people have overcome that. I mean, look at endurance racing. They race motorcycles at night in, you know, endurance racing. Sure.
But I'm just saying that, like, it would be just, like you're saying, it's going to be hard enough for them to switch from the quote-unquote morning practice, which is not going to be the afternoon practice, in daylight to the night practice, and like also throw in, you know, the beams of light along the track that you're gonna get, especially in the beginning of the race when lights are gonna be crossing, and you know you're now gonna be able to see somebody coming up on you and stuff like that. I mean, it really changes a lot if you have lights on the bike.
Yes, yeah, it's going to change a lot having artificial lighting. It's no matter what, but yeah. So yeah, that one's interesting. We should do a little bit of research and double check if there are any plans at this point, or if it's something they're even considering, or if it's just flat out no, the bikes will not have lights.
Right?
Do NASCARs don't have lights during a night race? Do they? I don't think they do. And when we see like the 24-hour Le Mans or something like that, where it's cars racing and they are lit, and those cars have lights, and rally. Oh man.
Oh yeah.
but those guys are out racing in a dark forest.
Right.
There are no lights except the giant bank of lights on the front of the car. So it won't be anything like that, but no, it's going to be interesting stuff. It will certainly be a change, and some change is good, some change is not, but all change is interesting. So if all else fails, we have that to fall back on. And maybe it'll drive the nail in the coffin of Qatar, or maybe it'll rejuvenate it. It's hard to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we've pretty much come to our self-imposed deadline because both of us do have real lives that tend to intrude and involve things like work and jobs and dogs with hurt feet and all of this sort of stuff. So I think it's about time to call it a day here, Jules.
Sounds good.
All righty. Well, it was nice talking to you. And again, as always, you know, thanks and enjoyed it. And we'll talk to you again real soon.
Okay, bub.
Bye.
Ciao.
That's going to do it for this week's show. I hope you enjoyed it. Like I said, it was a little bit shorter than they've been. So we're down to under an hour. Not necessarily going to be that way all the time. We'll just sort of see how it goes on a week-by-week basis. That's one of the nice things about MotoGPOD. We pretty much play it by ear. And on the continuing on the playing-it-by-ear sort of a plan, I'm not going to be doing a show next week because it's Thanksgiving week. And, you know, normally I could go ahead and say, well, Thanksgiving's Thursday. I'll go ahead and do the show on Wednesday, put it up. But that Wednesday is my birthday. So I'm going to be doing some stuff on that and everything. Pretty much a full week going on of the holiday routine kind of thing. So episode number 105 won't be for another 2 weeks. I will talk to you guys again on November 30th. Friday, November 30th. I am looking forward to it, and we should have some interesting stuff to talk about one way or the other as the teams finish up their testing before the December test ban, and who knows, a variety of other interesting topics and things that are somehow one way or another related to motorcycle racing. Might not be MotoGP, it might not even actually be truly racing, but it'll be enjoyable and you guys will like it. Like I said, we do have some things planned. I just have to sort of get organized and put it all together and do some editing and all of that kind of stuff, and sometimes that's kind of easier said than done. But whatever, it's been a good show. Thanks very much again to Jules, always a great co-host, and Kelly Welsh for her time on the phone, and to everybody that emailed me. If you'd like to email me, the address is bob@motogpod.com, and of course you can visit the website motogpod.com and leave comments and all that kind of business there. And do I encourage you, consider making a donation to the Make-A-Wish Foundation, preferably with Darren's Stash-a-thon or whatever they're calling it, where he's growing his mustache for 4 weeks, and they're going to have a little thing going on there of who can grow the best mustache and all of that, kind of a business. So just sort of a help out. Make sure that you share with others, especially coming up with the holiday season and all that. You never know. One of those kids might have a lifelong dream of going to a MotoGP round or something like that, and maybe you'll be able to help him make his dream come true. So we will talk to you again in 2 weeks. Don't forget, November 30th, and happy Thanksgiving to all of the United States listeners and to everybody else out there in the world that's not a United States listener. You might want to consider having turkey because it's good stuff. Well, in the interest of sounding more like a professional broadcast announcer, I decided to re-record my disclaimer in a slightly different manner today, so we're going to go ahead and do it in the radio voice. So, MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I am solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL, and the MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them.